Nat Arena, the third generation of Arenas to farm in Concord, is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at Arena Farms at 167 Fairhaven Road on January 13, 2003. Nat Arena will be 50 years old. You are a third generation farming the land.
Yeah.
And can you tell us about your grandfather?
Well, my grandfather came to this country in the early 1920s, and he arrived in the North End, and there were some friends and relatives there. And it's my understanding that they said there was work out on the farms of Concord. And he came to Concord in the 20s and started working for Mr. Wheeler, who owned a lot of land around town and had
That's
operating
Wilford
farms.
Wheeler.
I believe it was that Wheeler. And that, over the years, was able to settle the whole family out here in Concord on Old Bedford Road. And that's kind of how he got his start. And in the 40s, was able to purchase this land that our current farm stand is on now, and move the whole family to the house that they built, which is the house that's still right here.
So your land goes from Sudbury Road.
Well, back in the, when he purchased the land in the 40s, it went from all along Sudbury Road near what is now Crosby's Market. I think at the time it was the old coal tipple for the trains coming into Concord, the coal house, and all the way up into what is now Arena Terrace across Route 2. And at the time in the 30s, Route 2 ruined the farming out here. It was, they brought it around the edge of town and through some of this land that's out here, and that this was not a desirable location now that the highway is coming through here. And so that probably, if anything, lowered the value of the land in this area.
Mm-hmm. So that was quite a coverage of a lot of acreage.
Yeah, I believe it was almost 100 acres at the time that he was able to purchase. And part of the reason that we're still here as we go into the 21st century is back in the 50s, when most other farms in Concord sold out completely, my grandfather was able to develop part of the non-farmable land across Route 2 that is now Arena Terrace. And he sold house lots, and I believe at the time it was like $1,500 got you a house lot up there. And that was able to subsidize the operation of the farm through the 50s. So selling that asset kept the good farmland in production into the 60s, and it was divided in the late 50s into two parcels, one that my Uncle Angelo operated and one that my father John operated.
Now, in order to get a sense of the family, first of all, your grandfather's name was?
Natale,
okay. And how many children did he have?
Well, he had four sons. It would have been the oldest was Natale. And then there was Pat, and then Angelo, and John. He also had two daughters, Josephine and Mary. And the eldest son went off to World War II, and had sent letters back to Mr. Wheeler at the time talking about the agriculture in Italy that he was seeing. And,
I read those.
And, ideas that he would be bringing back with him, but unfortunately he didn't come back. Mm. And so the other three brothers, Pat, left the farm and went to work in a foundry-type situation, and Angelo and John ended up splitting the parcel that was left, and each got approximately half.
So when your grandfather came over, he came over in the early 20s of that?
It's my understanding that it was the early 20s, and that through the 30s that he actually worked off-season on helping to build Route 2, and that he would hold other jobs in the winter. I recall my father saying that he used to walk from Concord to Maynard, because that's where the mill was, to work in the winter, walk every day. Walk into Maynard and walk back.
Wow.
And I believe there was a trolley for a dime, but it wasn't worth it to him to spend the dime for the trolley. He'd just walk.
Incredible. Your grandmother's name was...
Santa was the grandmother that actually came over from Italy, because my father's mother passed away, I believe it was in the early 30s, and that now here was a widower with, you know, four sons and a daughter sitting in a house in Concord, and the Italian community was relatively established at that time, and, you know, people talked to people, and one of the neighboring families up the street, the Alessi, said, well, we've got someone who probably come over and marry you, and that's what happened. Santa Arena came over from Italy, came to the U.S., really didn't speak much English. Even as a child growing up, I remember most of the time it was Italian that she spoke. She could understand some English, but she came over and took over the family and had a daughter. Mary is her daughter, so... you know, it's a step family kind of situation, but stepped into, must have been a tough situation with four sons and a daughter already here.
Well, that's very impressive. So in the off-season, you said farmers worked on construction projects.
Yeah, I mean, they worked on whatever was going on in the area. If there was factory work available, they would do that. You know, I can remember that my father, even in the off-season through the 60s into the 70s, would drive a school bus for the town of Concord. And, of course, growing up in town, you know, he knew every street and everything. So he was the spare driver. Anybody who didn't show up by their assigned time, he could go out on any of the 20, 30, 40 routes that were established, and he knew all the routes, so he could substitute for anyone. And but, you know, that would be, you know, first thing in the morning, then he come back, those greenhouse work to do, and in the winter part, to get that done, and then he'd have to head back into the school bus for the afternoon.
I see. The kind of crops that were grown, were they any different than now?
Yeah, what was grown in this area in the early part of the century was asparagus. This was the asparagus basket of the world. And Middlesex County, in fact, was the number one agricultural county in the United States back in the early 1900s. And this was before there was really Florida agriculture and way before California agriculture. And so this county has a major historical part in agriculture in the United States. And a lot of the technology that helped farming around the country, around the world, was developed in this area. Even, I mean, the Waltham butternut squash that revolutionized squash production in the 50s was developed here at the Waltham Field Station.
Wow.
And a lot of the carrots from the late 40s, early 50s were developed here. And Waltham broccoli also developed here, that kind of revolutionized broccoli production. So it was kind of the mecca for agriculture up until probably the late 30s, early 40s is when it started to shift away.
Now, during the 40s, at the time of World War II, were farmers assigned specific crops to grow?
Yes, it's my understanding has been told to me that root crops, things like carrots and radishes, were really asked for by the War Department. There were lots of greenhouses in the Lexington area, many, probably could have been 100 acres of greenhouse, which, you know, today, I don't think there's 3 acres of greenhouse. So there were many, many greenhouses, and what their crops were traditionally were winter lettuce, because if you wanted lettuce in the 20s and 30s, you didn't get it shipped in. You had it grown locally. That was the only way to get it. But as the War Production Board decided what was important, that these root crops would be grown on the East Coast and brought into Boston, and then they could be shipped right across to Europe, and they would survive. They would be able to hold for a few weeks and still be a good product. So this is something that I know our family here was asked to grow a lot of carrots, and I believe they also grew a lot of radish and parsnip. And in fact, we still have the old diesel tractor that was like a War Department diesel tractor that the family got in 1944 to work the fields. And I believe it was the first diesel tractor in Concord.
Really? Wow.
And so that worked, you know, I can remember, I think it was probably up until 1970 or so that that tractor was actively working. So, and at the time, a diesel tractor could use, you know, the number 2 fuel oil or diesel fuel, which was less of a priority for the war effort than the high-octane gasoline, which the airplanes needed. So, you know, it was a way to shift from gasoline tractors to diesel tractors.
At what point in time did asparagus run into problems with rust?
The asparagus rust problem really started taking hold in the 30s. Probably, and really the crop was virtually gone by the late 30s. And this was a problem of a soil-borne disease getting established, that the varieties of asparagus that were being grown were all very similar. So it was something that... once it got established, it really caused a big problem. And a lot of people don't realize that asparagus is a perennial crop. You seed it, and it takes 5 to 7 years to pick the first spear of asparagus. And so it's something that you've got this big upfront investment. Now, you do pick it for 20 years once it's established, but if it runs into a problem, it takes you 5 to 7 years to get back into it.
I see. Following World War II, in 1946, your grandfather builds the farmhouse here.
Yeah. He was able to have purchased this land all around here, and you know, with the 3 boys and the 2 girls, I guess it was pretty crowded in the small house on Bedford Street, and so he built a nice... new house out here on the edge of town on Fairhaven Road, and that's the house that's here today.
And then when did the stand begin? A couple years later?
Yeah, the I think the progression was the house was built in 46, and then I believe the greenhouse was built soon after that, 48 or 49, and the farm stand, the first small little farm stand, went up in 49. And with the turn off of Route 2, and you could probably put 3 or 4 cars in there at any given time, but that was all that you needed. There was not a lot of traffic on Route 2, that's for sure.
Where Neshadik Country Club is, there used to be an Andy Boy farm.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that's a company that's still in existence today out in California and Florida. And one of their first operations was out here in Concord, and all those nice, rich fields out in Concord. The problem was it was in the floodplain of the Concord River. So 19, I think it was 54, and then again in 56, we had multiple hurricanes in a given year, and the flooding was extreme. And I've seen photographs of them out in a canoe picking broccoli. And again, broccoli is a long season crop. At that time of year, there really wasn't such a thing as a spring broccoli crop. You would grow the plants all summer long and start harvesting probably in late August and harvest September, October, even into November. And so when a hurricane hits in early September, it hits while you have all your expense of the crop in the ground and you haven't brought anything in yet. My father was also greatly affected by the hurricanes in the 50s. He was basically a carrot grower at that time and had purchased all the line equipment to have an 8 or 10 man crew pack carrots. And he had the digger machine that would go out in the field and be able to dig the carrot quickly, and the carrot washing system where you could dump the carrots in, and it would go through this washing machine and onto a conveyor belt where it could be packed into 1 pound bags and shipped out. And he probably was growing at that time 60 acres of carrots, which is a lot of carrots.
Oh, it sure is.
And to grow a real good carrot, generally you need a soil that's got some clay in it. And the fields in Sudbury where he was growing this, if you have a field with some clay in it and you get 20 inches of rain, you can't even walk on that field for, as it turned out, weeks. And what happens is the carrot soil is waterlogged so long that the carrots rot. It'd be just like submerging them totally in water. And so for 2 out of 3 years there, he basically didn't pick a crop. And that lesson was the lesson to diversify, that never should one crop be the crop that is produced. That my ideal would be that no one crop is more than 10% of what we do, would be my ideal. And that's what we've worked toward here the past 30 years, is that there is no one thing that we do that if something happens to that crop that it's financially devastating. That no matter what season, there's always some crop that's going to grow really good and some crop that's not going to grow really good. So you just have such a widespread of things that you're growing that you can't get hurt by a very wet year or a very dry year.
Now, you don't just rely on conquered land to grow.
Correct. We lease property all over the place. We actually have about 26 acres of land in Sudbury that we were able to purchase in the late 70s. It was one of the first APR parcels that became available.
Explain APR.
APR is Agricultural Preservation Restriction, which means that this land is perpetually deeded as agricultural land, that the state and the town got together and contributed money to the landowner to take the development rights off of the property. So if you've got land that's worth $10,000 an acre as building land and worth $1,000 an acre as farming land, the difference is $9,000 an acre. That gets paid to the landowner. He signs off the deed on the building rights, and that the land is now agricultural land, can be sold as agricultural land, is taxed as agricultural land at the much lower value, which theoretically farmers can afford down the road.
See. So this was around in 1978, you
I
think,
think it was
yeah.
78, and again, it was the very first parcels that were available under that program. And at the time, we went to the Concord Co-op Bank to take out a loan. I remember having to convince the bank people that you know, this was an okay thing that other farmers, if we didn't, you know, weren't able to pay off the loan, that other farmers would, and they had to foreclose, that it wasn't useless land. There were other farmers out there. And to their credit, you know, they stood behind us, and you know, we did pay it all off, and it's now ours.
You mentioned, I think, earlier when we talked, that it was around $16,000, the
Yeah, I believe the total total amount we financed was only about $16,000 mm-hmm. in the late 70s, which wasn't a lot, and I think we did it for like a 15-year loan. It wasn't you know, a very long-term loan. But that particular parcel that we purchased has all different kinds of soil types on it. There's everything from very sandy soil to very clay soil there. And with our kind of operation that grows all kinds of different things, it was an asset. Most other farms would want all similar soil types. If they're growing pretty much one or two different things, you want basically uniform soil. But for us growing hundreds of different things, this was perfect for us. And we're still there today, and it's still very productive. In fact, the giant pumpkins that we grow the past few years have come off of that property.
So it's about 26 acres?
It's about 26 acres as the whole parcel. There's probably about 20 acres of usable farmland. There's still old stone walls and ponds, and it's just a very picturesque New England-looking little valley out there. It's been good for us, but we have had to lease land from the town of Wayland. We've had land out there for many years. We still lease a few parcels from the town of Lincoln. We have land in Concord that's national park land that we lease from the National Park Service. So we're still pretty dependent on this leased land in the area to keep our agricultural production enough to supply what we're looking for here.
Leasing land is very unpredictable, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's better now than it was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, you would go to lease land and it was always just for 1 year. And so every year you'd have to go and try to re-up the lease. And if you limed a field, and lime is a long-term land modification, that you wouldn't be able to even get use of that lime for a year or two, and you might lose that parcel the next year. So at my urging, and with help from the State Department of Agriculture, a uniform lease procurement policy was established with towns. And now the standard lease is 5 years. And I would still like to see more of a long-term lease arrangement worked out with farmers. I would love to see 10, 20-year leases on this these properties. Or at least that you get to, you know, reissue the 5-year lease unless the farmer has really done something wrong. But again, this is becoming a political issue in some towns, and that leases are given to nonprofit organizations and to politically active organizations to do who knows what with. But it's kind of my opinion that farmland that is designated as farmland should be available to first to active farmers in the area. That if there is no farmer looking for land, then it can revert to some other use. But farmers are going to be the absolute best stewards of the land. Farmers were environmentalists 100 years ago. And all these fields that you've got left around, places that have been designated in the town of Wayland, they needed a new well. Where did they go? They went to where the farm was, and then promptly restricted the use of the farm around the well. Well, for 40 years the land was used, they tested for the well, it was fine, but now that we've pumping water from there, now you can't farm it. Well, that's what kept the land in good shape to begin with. So there are some crazy things that go on out there. But
it's like a catch 22.
Yeah.
And another catch 22 is obviously you respond to what people want you to grow. But because the public really doesn't know much about growing, you're sometimes caught in this, like with that organic farming.
Yeah, it's been something that started to take off 20 years ago, that crops grown organically were perceived as being something that was healthier and better for you, and free of pesticides, and that people kind of started looking for this product. And I remember at the time that a lot of the supermarkets kind of, all of a sudden there was organic sections in the supermarkets, and most of those failed. I mean, within a couple of years, they were not there anymore.
That was early 80s?
That would be, early 80s. And it's something that we as growers kind of keep an eye on, but we realize that the food product that hits the shelves in the United States is by far the best, cleanest. It's what's contributing to the rise in the standard of living and the rise in the longevity of people, is to have a good, clean source of food. And that most people, when interviewed, would say that they would buy organic, and they will check off all the proper politically correct boxes. But when given a choice at a supermarket of buying green beans that might be a little bent, have a little spot or two on them, or other green beans that are virtually perfect, and that the spotted ones are $1.99 a pound and the perfect looking ones are 99 cents a pound, a lot of that organic checkoff goes out the window as they pick up the 99 cent beans. Supermarkets know that people shop with their eyes, and supermarkets take big advantage of that. And a lot of the growers around the country who are the big wholesale producers know that, and they will produce varieties that look really, really good. What we can do as local growers is, because we don't have to ship things 5 to 7 days, we can produce a crop that not only looks very good, but it tastes good too.
Mm-hmm.
When we're ordering seed from seed catalogs, there are thousands of varieties of all kinds of vegetables and small fruits. And one of our things to consider is, what's this going to eat like? I mean, ultimately, people are going to eat this product. And being a direct farmer-to-consumer person, the people who buy it from us, if it tastes good, they're going to come back and buy it again. Whereas a supermarket situation, the grower selling it at the supermarket knows that the buyer is just interested in, how good does it look, and how good is it going to look 7 days from now? And that's the only thing driving their variety selection, is the fact that this strawberry is rock hard, will ship across the country. Or what really gets me is the vine-ripened tomatoes that are picked dead green, and they go into a box that says vine-ripened. And on the way north, there, boxcar is filled up with ethylene gas, and what that's a ripening agent, a natural ripening agent. And all those green tomatoes turn red in like 3 days. So what you're getting on the shelf is a very firm, which people love, bright red, which people love, green tomato, and that's why it doesn't have any taste.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we as local growers are able to do is to grow tomatoes that really taste good, and that's the one crop that people haven't lost their taste buds about. that most people will know a good tomato when they taste it, and that's what gets them back here. That's why we grow those greenhouse tomatoes in the spring and spend all that time and energy and effort. And I haven't been able to verify it, but we may be the only place in the state that's grown greenhouse tomatoes from the late 40s till 2003, virtually every single year. I think the
Very
only
impressive.
I think the only year we missed was the year of the fire, and in 95, and it just took us 1 year to kind of get our tomato crop reestablished in another new greenhouse that we put up. But we've been doing that back in the old days when we used to steam sterilize the soil. I would get home from school, and it was my job to go in there and dig a ditch in the greenhouse, two 35-foot ditches, 2.5, 3 feet deep, lay a metal steam pipe in there, perforated pipe, hook it up to an old fire hose, and we'd run the steam boiler and literally cook the ground to 180 degrees,
wow.
Put a plastic tarp over it, and would run at 4 or 5 pound steam pressure so the tarp would puff up. And then it would have to cool for a day, and you'd go in the day after, and you would kind of clean your shoes off so you wouldn't contaminate the steamed soil, and you'd have to dig the pipe back out of the hot soil, still hot, and then redig a new trench in the cold soil immediately next to it and move the whole system one greenhouse section to the next section, and it would take to do the 13 sections a few weeks of steaming the soil to sterilize it, because greenhouse tomatoes, if you've got a disease going in the greenhouse, it would quickly spread from plant to plant. We were probably one of the first farms to use the new bag culture back in the early 80s. And what we would do with the bags is we started out with basically bags of potting soil, and you would grow 2 or 3 plants in a bag. And if you had a disease get started with a plant, it would only go as far as the bag. And so that you would only lose 2 or 3 plants. You wouldn't, within a short time, lose 20 or 30 tomato plants to a root disease that would get going. And I can remember at the time I would went down to the dump and picked at the dump and got the electric valves off of old washing machines. And that's how I hooked up the watering system, because each bag needed a little tiny hose going into it because you couldn't hand water. And automatically, 3 or 4 times a day, these electric valves would kick on. And that's how I watered those first crops of tomatoes. Now, of course, there's real equipment that you can buy that does the job. But back then, you had to improvise.
Now, you have managed to extend the growing season longer and longer.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that some of the state universities have really helped with. When I was up at UNH, that was a lot of the research was being done with plastic row covers and plastic mulches on the ground. And so this is something that's been what we've done in the long term, and just year after year looking at a way to get a little earlier jump on the season, and then possibly with frost protection in the fall, extend the season another week or two. That's important in New England. Our growing season is limited.
Can you describe the function of the Agriculture Association?
Yeah. In New England, we're fortunate to have a very good association of growers. It started out as the Boston Market Gardeners Association, evolved into the New England Vegetable Growers. It's now called the New England Vegetable and Berry Growers Association. And this is the oldest growers association in the United States. I believe it got started in the 1890s, or late 1880s. And what we do is we have 4 winter meetings a year, and we'll bring in people from around the country who are experts in their particular field of whatever we want some information on. be it new varieties of sweet corn, new weed control methods for pumpkins and squash. And there's, you know, a lot of research work done at various universities around the country. And we'll get that person here with his report that probably isn't even published yet to talk to our growers. And so this gets the information directly to the people who can use it. And it's been a very good thing for agriculture in New England. It's something that it's still trying to be duplicated at other places around the country. There are other associations out there now based on what was established here in New England and Middlesex County back in the late 1800s.
It's very impressive.
Yeah, and it's a good active organization. We have, I believe, about 400 active members right now. And again, primarily you have to be a commercial vegetable grower who's, you earn your living doing that. New members apply to the organization, and if they are an unknown entity, someone in the area will go out and see what kind of operation we're talking about. If it's somebody, you know, growing a little backyard garden, that doesn't get you into the group. You have to be someone who is attempting to make a living growing fruits and vegetables. And that gets you into our organization and gets you all the benefits and the camaraderie and the information. And, you know, growers will always help each other. I mean, there are some growers who are not members in the Concord area even. But Concord over the years has been, you know, a real location of some of the top people in the organization. And I was fortunate about 10 or 15 years ago to be elected president of the association and served my 2 years. And still, I'm active on a couple of committees. I've been kind of busy here the past few years trying to rebuild after the fire that we had. But it's something that I really realize the benefit of this organization.
You are doing more than just rebuilding. This is a very exciting time right now.
Yeah, I mean, for years we had the original small farm stand, which was maybe 15 by 20 feet, and that was added to out the back, added to on the left side, added to on the right side, and lean-to upon lean-to for a number of years. Back in 75, we did a major reconstruction where we kind of consolidated the footprint of all these various lean-tos under one massive roof, and we were able to do that during the course of a summer, building it ourselves without closing. And I still don't know exactly how we did it, but we did. We put this whole new building up basically over the top of everything that was there and then pulled everything down on the inside. And we were open every single day, not closed for one. This new building...
When did you say that?
That was back in 1975.
Okay.
And this new building is a little bigger, more ambitious than that. And it is in a completely new location that up until the time we were going to put the building there, it was basically open field. And but our intention is when we do move into it this summer that we will only be closed for a day or two as we move operations from our current buildings into the new setup. And, be open for business on a given Monday, closed probably on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then open in the new place on Thursday. And, of course, everybody will work like crazy for 2 days to accomplish that, but that's what we want to try to do when it's time to move in.
And you will be offering more.
Yeah, what we initially in the new setup, what we want to do is exactly what we've been doing, but just be able to do it better.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to sell produce out of a greenhouse like we've been forced to do for 7 years. It just, no matter what, the sun comes through the roof and it heats up in there on us a little bit. To be in a building with a real roof, that's going to be a thrill again. It's going to be so much easier to be in a building that is organized so each department has its own area that they can pre-assemble things and get things ready to go out to sell is going to be very good. The produce area, you can bring produce from the field, bring it in the back door, wash it, get it ready to go out, bring it out front and sell it, and it doesn't interfere with the cut flower department or plant department or the various pottery and other plant gifts that we put out there. Each department has its own specific area that it can operate in, and all departments can run at the same time, which is going to be very good. As we get ourselves reestablished with everything that we've done in the past, then we're looking at what other new things should we be doing. We want to get our salad bar back in operation because we did have that in the old setup. We know how to do salad bars, so let's do that. But we've also realized that today people want prepared foods. So you can come in here and you can get a little container of something that you just take home and heat and eat it up. So there's all that preparing that you would have to spend time doing. We can do it here more efficiently and use top quality product to do it. I think that's going to be the difference over what you would get at another prepared food place, is that carrot that we're using was growing that morning and you're eating it that night. There's not too many places that are able to claim that.
As you reach your 50th birthday in August of this year, you are still a young farmer in comparison to other current Concord farmers. I almost wonder whether you will be the last grower left.
30 years ago when I was first on the board of New England Vegetable Growers Association, I remember going to one of the first meetings and the next oldest member was more than twice my age on the board of directors at that time. So there are, you know, some young growers coming along, but not too many in this area, it seems. It's something that unless you're born into it, you're not going to be able to afford to go and buy land and establish a farm. The agricultural preservation program is trying to help that out so that growers don't have to pay $200,000 an acre to go buy land. There should be some of this restricted land around that you can pay substantially less for, probably less than 10% of that, and potentially keep farming it and be able to grow crops and sell crops and earn a living. But, you know, I don't see any vast influx of young people into agriculture at this time. It's still something that's difficult, especially the vegetable end of the business. The greenhouse end of the business is something a little different, and I think there are a lot of younger people into that. It doesn't quite cost as much to get going. The return is better. I mean, we see it here in being a farm that does everything, that we very rarely will get a complaint about someone buying a geranium for $3 or $4, but buying a tomato at $3 or $4 a pound, that gets some comment.
Do you try to dovetail operations, growing, with other farmers?
Yeah, I think that this is something that's really going to happen a lot more in the future, as there really are not that many farmers left around here. We're going to make more of an effort to do what we've historically done some of, which is try to talk to a local grower, see what they are growing, and find out if what they're growing anyway will be something that we then don't have to produce ourselves and that we can buy their crop. We had done this in the early 80s with Mr. Breen on the other side of Concord, and he was a great grower of strawberries, and we would just go over there and purchase all his strawberries for him. In fact, we would send our crew over to pick them for the most part, and worked out great for him. He had a ready market for all the strawberries he could grow. Worked out good for us. That's a very specific crop, and we didn't have to try to produce a strawberry crop. We could focus more attention on our other produce crops.
He lived in the Thoreau house.
He lived in what is now Thoreau Homestead over there. And now there's another, you know, nice little parcel of land out there that, you know, if a farmer, a commercial farmer, got a hold of it, could probably do a very nice job with it long term. But over the past 10 or 15 years, there's been various groups in there trying to do what they can to do other than growing crops for commercial purposes. And it's something that I think that it's not really the best use of the property.
Yes, I see your point. So there aren't really the younger farmers coming up, and you may be the last grower in Concord.
Well, I've never thought of it that way. I would expect that as the next 10 years evolve, that there'll be someone else stepping into some farm around here that will be younger or just able to get on top of the situation that's going on that particular farm. You know, we don't know what's even going to happen with our particular farm in the next generation. The oldest is still only 10 years old, so no determination has been made there, that's for sure. But it's something that traditionally you've kind of had to grow up on a farm to be able to operate a farm.
Mm-hmm.
That experience is worth more than any schooling that you can get.
Yes.
And I went to school, I studied plant science, I did everything that college could teach you, and it did teach me a lot, but the experience of being in that particular field for 10 or 15 years and knowing what happens in that particular field, that's at least equal to whatever technical scientific things you can learn in college. I mean, agriculture is a science and an art. To do it the way we do it, growing for retail and growing over 100 different things.
You have a younger brother.
Yeah, I do have a younger brother, and I've got two sisters with kids. And again, it's available, I guess, to any of them who express an interest that, you know, if they're interested in agriculture, that it's available to them to come up and to take advantage and test it out. There are many other easier ways to earn a living, but to me it's satisfying. I mean, I really never had any doubts growing up that this was what I wanted to do, and it's always a challenge. It's always something different, that every season is different, every year is different. So just because you got it all right last year, you know, it's almost like, you know, a baseball team or whatever, that all the pieces could work for one year, and then the next year one little thing is different, and that throws everything off, and you have to, you know, we could have the best plan in the book. April 1st, everything's all planned out for the whole year. April 10th, something happens that's not on the plan, and that plan is gone for the season, and now we're kind of trying to stick to the plan, but realizing that you have to improvise. You have to, whatever the elements give you, you have to try to take advantage of and make use and just work with what you've got for that season. You can't just say we're going to grow 40 acres of corn come hell or high water, because you will get both of those over the years.
But your new operation allows you to have outreach directly with a customer more and more.
Yeah, I think, again, that's what's been what people like about coming to a local farm, is that they're talking to the people who are growing the product. If they've got a question or a comment about a particular item, or if we're trying a new variety of something, we can talk to customers and say, how do you like this new green pepper? Or, you know, and is there something about it that we didn't consider in the way that you prepare it or cook it, or you know, how long does it keep a few days and still look good? I mean, I can remember when super sweet corn came on the market a few years ago. There was a new technology, and everyone, this was back when I was president of New England Vegetable Growers, and I can remember at the time saying, it's going to change the way we sell corn, and that you don't need to get the pot boiling anymore, run and pick the corn and throw it in the pot, that these new varieties don't have the enzyme that converts sugar to starch, so as you pick the corn and the sugar that's in the corn stays in the corn. It never gets converted. It just stays there. And you can pick that ear of corn, put it on your counter for 3 days, and then peel it, throw it in a pot of water, and it's still 95% as sweet as the day you picked it. And you couldn't do that with regular corn. In a matter of hours, that corn would respirate it. The corn is still living, and it uses up its sugar to continue to try to grow. And so within hours, all the sugar sweetness in the corn is converted to starch, and it just becomes very bland. And so now when we, you know, grow our sweet corn and then pick it, we'll pick a truckload of corn, and it might be that that corn lasts for 2 days. We don't have to go out every single day and pick. Most of the time we do, but if we know it's going to be a very rainy day the next day, or this going to be a very hot day and the corn will overgrow, we will pick it when it's ripe, bring it in, and we don't even have to refrigerate it. We pour some water on it, keep it hydrated, and that corn quality is excellent. And, you know, that's new technology that really has changed the way people think about sweet corn. We sell sweet corn in the stand now starting in March from Florida. And 15 years ago, we never sold sweet corn unless it was our own, because it never tasted any good. Why sell something that wasn't any good? But this corn that is the super sweet hybrids, the major difference is tenderness. There are some varieties that keep really, really well, but they're very crispy, very hard, even after you cook them. And there's others that grow a nice big ear, and they're tender, and so those are the ones that we tend to try to grow.
Well, that's very interesting. I had the opportunity around 1987 to speak with a cousin and uncle of yours that are no longer here, and I wonder if we could have just brief mention of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what helped our end of the business, Arena Farms, grow, was their end of the business, which was A Arena Farms. Now, these were two independent operations, yet we shared technology, we shared equipment at times. Why should we both have this certain kind of cultivator if they only needed to use it 5 days and we only needed to use it 5 days? Well, we'd figure out that we could share that piece of equipment. And helped each other out with marketing of wholesale product. We had big shipping to Stop and Shop and other supermarkets in the late 70s and early 80s. And their operation was the premier lettuce growing operation in New England.
This
would be my Uncle Angelo and my cousin Nat. All the first sons are named after the grandfather, so our family has had three Nat Arenas. So it does get confusing, but the family rated them by date of birth as Nat number one, Nat number two, Nat number three. So at Christmas time, you would look at Nat, and then you would look for the Roman numeral after your name to know if that was your present or not.
And were you two?
I was number one, actually.
Oh, okay.
I was the oldest. And so again, their operation that Angelo and my cousin Nat had down the street was by far the premier lettuce operation in the state. And they had the only hydro cooler operation in the state, which you could pick lettuce out of the field and put it through the machine, and it would take all the heat out of it, and then you could ship it to a supermarket, and it would arrive with its temperature in the 30s. Because again, the supermarkets They liked the fresh stuff, but it had to be able to keep for a week. And the only way you could accomplish that was taking that field heat right out of it. So it was this huge machine that he put in, and I mean, that's what the people who wanted to buy the product needed. So that's what we did. That's kind of been our mantra over the years, is whatever customer we're talking to, it's what do you need? And then it's our job to provide that. And I think that's just a good way to go about what we're doing.
Your cousin Nat had an unfortunate accident. So just briefly, what time period was that?
That was in March of 89.
Okay.
And he, in addition to the farming, the other thing that he did was he had these various trucks and equipment. He had his trailer truck for delivering his own product. And he had the plow truck for the state and the sander truck. And he would do all his repairs himself. I mean, he had a complete garage down there, very knowledgeable about anything mechanical, had rebuilt a couple of vehicles, frame-up restorations of old vehicles, so was very knowledgeable about that. And this particular week, he had had the truck was being used by Agway to store their frozen foods, and this was the same truck that for the WBZ farm stand, he would give it to them for a week so they could put their product in it for when they had to have their sale of product to benefit Children's Hospital. So, you know, this truck was around, and it had a flat tire, and he took it back and was preparing to fix that tire, and basically it exploded before he even had a lot of air in it. I mean, he knew the procedure for doing a split rim tire, had the chains on the ground and everything, and it just was a fluke. Near as we can tell, the tire rotated on the rim, created rubber dust inside the tire. When you slam the tire on the ground, the dust floated up. Rubber dust is organic, like grain dust. You've heard of grain silos exploding. And he had a leak on the rim, and he went to weld the rim up, and that rubber dust inside probably ignited and blew up the tire. And my uncle was in the building at the same time, and he was severely injured, never really came back 100%, and passed away about 7 or 8 years later. But my cousin Nat never knew what hit him that day.
He was in his 30s.
I believe he was like 32 at the time. Yeah, so a few years younger than me at the time. And again, you know, we help each other out, and it was a great situation to basically have another farm right down the street that, between the two of us, we were probably the largest agricultural operation in the state at the time.
So it's left to you to carry on?
It's left to me and my brother John, and so we're, you know, we're doing what we can, but we're definitely focusing on the retail and, you know, kind of carrying that forward with the new building to really allow us to properly display and retail this bounty of product that we've been able to produce over the years.
So the retail is the way to, quote, grow.
In New England, the biggest crop is customers. If you look around, there's lots of houses, there's lots of people. If you go to other parts of the country, the Midwest, even California Valley area, there's not a huge population immediately adjacent to the fields. So they have to ship distance to get to their market. We're fortunate in New England that our market is all around us. And we just have to work with much smaller fields, much more spread out. We go as far as 5 miles away with our tractors to work fields. So that's the disadvantage. But again, the advantage is that there's, you know, a million customers within 25 miles. So that's, you know, not too bad of a trade-off.
Well, I'm very glad you're here, and best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you.